offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, joining you from our studios at Prashanthi Nilayam, and it's a pleasure to be with you again. We are in the fourth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, and as you all know, we go through the Gita verse by verse and trying to understand in depth the meaning of each of those verses, trying to understand the meaning of each of the words used in the verse. And understandably, our pace has been quite slow, and I think it shouldn't matter, except for the fact that it becomes a little difficult if we want to revisit some of these episodes and probably get a sneak preview of what Krishna is saying in a chapter. But I think the purpose of probably this series is not that. It's as much as possible to perform what Swami would call Shravanam, Mananam and Nididhyasanam. Because a lot of the facts that are mentioned in the Gita, the lot of the message that is given by Krishna through the Gita is, as we can see, quite repetitive in that sense. The nature of the text itself is such, and the reason for that being that this is meant to be repeated again and again for the mind, and we'll speak about that also briefly today. So in that sense, I think it doesn't matter that we're going so slowly, and instead of trying to learn the Gita or trying to master the Gita, I think that's not the idea of any of us. That's not my idea, and I hope that's not the idea of the listeners. The idea is to perform the act of Shravanam and give these thoughts to our mind to perform the Mananam so that the Nididhyasanam happens. As always, let's begin with a short summary of what we covered last time. We did only two verses last time, and we are going to be doing only two verses today too, because it's an important concept which needs a little more deliberation, and that's why we'll spend more time on that. We covered verses 21 and 22, but we started off with a short discussion on verse 20, where Krishna uses a few phrases to describe the jnani, which is more useful for a karma yogi than a jnani. And I think that's been the refrain in the past couple of verses, where Krishna is describing the jnani, but all of these are hints for a karma yogi. And some of the verses we saw last time, and some of the verses we'll be seeing it in this week's episode too. One of the words or phrases that Krishna uses is tyaktva karmafala asangam, which means the jnani doesn't have any deep attachments to the results. Well, truly speaking, the jnani has no attachments at all. So when Krishna says that he has no deep attachments, it is clearly a hint to the karma yogi, and that is not it is not possible for you and me, if we could define ourselves as karma yogi, or at least aspiring karma yogis, it's not possible for us to completely not think about the results at all. But at least we can start by avoiding deep attachment to the results, and that is the hint that Krishna is dropping there. The same pattern continues into the 21st shloka as well, where Krishna says, a jnani does not have specific aspirations, or is, in other words, open to multiple possibilities. He then calls the jnani a yatachittatma, one who has his mind under control. We had discussed how the karma yogi is trying to do what the jnani does, and this is the same which happened in the second chapter too, when Arjuna asked the question, how does stita prajna talk, how does he walk, and how does he carry himself? The whole idea is to be able to reproduce in action, reproduce in decisions and choices, how a jnani acts. But the difference between a jnani and a karma yogi is that a jnani has no mind, while the karma yogi still has one, and one has to figure out ways by which this mind is dealt with. And that is where all the forms of mind disciplining come into play, and we'll be talking about one very important aspect today. Then Krishna goes on to say, one who is like this, that is self-controlled and has no possessiveness and is self-satisfied, such a person even if he or she acts, only the body acts, but there is no karma at all. And we had also seen how there's another way of looking at this very statement, which is kevalam shariram karma kurvan. One is to think of it as he only does bodily actions. The other way of looking at it is as he acts only as much as it is necessary for the upkeep of the body, which again becomes a very, very important and direct clue to the karma yogi. Nothing wrong in giving the body and the senses what they seek, but it must never be detached from the purpose, and invariably the purpose is the minimum upkeep of the body. You do not cater to the cravings of the body, and that is one more way by which you can interpret this description that Krishna gives of a jnani. In the 22nd verse, there are again few more such statements that Krishna makes. He says, yadrichha labha santushto. The jnani is pleased with whatever comes his way, whatever comes by means of a fortune or luck in that sense. And we had discussed what do we refer to as fortune or luck? That for which we have not labored, right? So another way of looking at this statement becomes, he sees everything that comes his way as a gift of providence, which means he negates his karmic involvement in the result that has come, right? That is one very beautiful way of discarding doership. So that again becomes a tip to all of us, where can we look at everything that happens to our life, especially positive and achievements, as you can look at it as a blessing from God. That is one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is there are multiple possibilities, and among that, this one possibility has happened, and that itself is a sign of a fortune, and that's what we refer to as a luck. You know, if you have a lucky draw or if you have a lottery, there are thousands of people participating, and if my name gets picked up, that's a sign of luck, that, you know, any name could have been picked up. There were 1,000 possibilities, and this one possibility of my name being picked up happened, and that's what we refer to as luck. So similarly, when we say that he is a yadricha labha santushto, it means any kind of thing could have happened. This particular thing happened, which is which I like it, which I look at it as a fortunate thing to happen. So this cannot be claimed by me by saying that I did this and that is why this happened. And that is a means by which you reduce or negate doership. Then Krishna uses the word vimatsaraha, meaning that he is free from envy. Again, it is a redundant description for a jnani, right? The moment you say he is an atma-santushta, who is constantly satisfied with his own self, you don't need to describe him as somebody who is not jealous or who is not envious. But still Krishna gives this beautiful word, vimatsaraha, as a description of a jnani, because this again, as we saw, I read out a couple of excerpts from Swami's discourses too. Swami speaks of jealousy and hatred as being a very, very important flaws in the character that a sadhaka has to pay attention to, right? And that is the reason why Krishna is specifically mentioning the jnani as being someone who does not have envy. And finally, he says, the jnani is one who looks at success and failure, and he's beyond dvandva or duality. These are all descriptions which we've seen when Krishna spoke about the sthita prajna too, and Krishna spoke about in general of the Atman itself, right? So in that sense, these are all repetitive, and there's a purpose for this, right? The Vedanta always repeats some of these things. It's because I think we'll come across, I'll explain that further in today's session too. When we talk about jnana, it is different. For us, it is not yet jnana. For us, it is something that is a utility to us, right? Just like the Swami gives the analogy of us having bath every day, right? Yes, the act of having bath cleanses us, but we are in a state where we need that repeated cleansing. That one act is not enough to make us eternally pure. So our relationship with all of this spiritual content that we are going through is like our physical relationship with water. just that one tryst with water is not going to make us eternally pure. Similarly, for us, since it is only data, it is only bookish knowledge, truly speaking, our relationship with this jnana is like our relationship with water. We need to constantly keep doing mananam with some of these spiritual truths, so that itself becomes one of the ways by which the mind is managed. As I said, for a karma yogi, that becomes one of the most important things when he is trying to imitate the jnani. The mind has to be managed because the jnani does not have that trouble. So with that, we'll go into the next verse. This is verse number 23. As always, it's beautifully rendered in the voice of Brother Shyam. We'll listen to it. I'll give you a brief meaning after that, and then we'll discuss in detail.
Gata sangasya muktasya jnanavasthita cetasaha yajnayacharatah karma samagram praviliyate.
The action gets dissolved completely in the case of the person who undertakes it for the sake of a sacrifice, who is rid of attachment and is freed, and who has his mind fixed in wisdom. So that's verse number 23. The next couple of verses from this point, Krishna is going to speak about performing actions as a yajna. This is a topic which has been already mentioned in the Gita. In the beginning of the third chapter, Krishna had said, yajnyarthat karmanaha anyatra lokaha ayam karma bandhanaha. Meaning, except for actions that is performed for a yajna, in this world, everything binds, or karma in this world binds everything else. Right? In this portion of the Gita, starting from this verse till the end of the chapter, Krishna speaks about the concept of yajna in further detail. But the word yajna itself has many, many connotations to it, and I'm not going to repeat all of those interpretations. I think we've done all of that when Krishna spoke about yajna in the third chapter, in the beginning of the third chapter, and we went back into Swami's discourses. Swami gave different interpretations for the word yajna, and when Krishna says that actions have to be performed as yajna, we saw how it can be interpreted based on these explanations that Swami gives. So we'll not go back into that. But here what I'm referring to is the ritual practice of yajna, or the fire sacrifice itself. And Krishna is specifically making a mention of that. When Krishna says yajnas can liberate a person, that statement actually can be misunderstood, or I would say rather partially understood. But maybe before that, we will see in this shloka that the reference is still to a jnani, though the reference is, there is a mention about the ritualistic practice of doing a yajna, the discussion is still about the nature of a jnani. Not any other type of a person, but a jnani. That is something that we'll have to keep in mind. Because the jnani might have been anything in the past. He could have been a kshatriya, he could have been a poet, he could have been a brahmin who did a lot of yajnas, he could have been a priest, he could have been a housewife, he could have been a philanthropist. But whatever was his past, the moment he becomes a jnani, the jnani is described only on the basis of that knowledge or jnana that he has. He is a jnani, and that is the best description that you can give him. And Krishna is describing a jnani and also talking about a yajna, and the pattern that has been followed, whatever Krishna is giving as a description of a jnani, is all of these are hints for a karma yogi. Right? Because a jnani is best defined by his jnana, and that's all it is there is to be said about a jnani. Why am I making this very particular point? We will see this when we speak about the concept of yajna itself. But first we look at the shloka itself. Krishna makes it very clear that it is a jnani by saying, gata sangasya muktasya. That is the first description he says. Sangha means attachment. Gata sangasya means one in whom all the attachments have left. Gata, they've left. And he says, muktasya, one who is completely liberated. Then he goes on to say, Jnana avasthita chetasaha. One whose mind is deeply rooted in jnana. Avasthita means established or strongly rooted, and chetasaha is mind. Jnana avasthita chetasaha. Even we have jnana, right? But we have it as information. And when I say jnana, I'm talking about Brahma jnana, or the fact that I'm not this body, I'm not this mind, I'm the soul, and the soul is divine, right? Even we have that jnana because we have it as a piece of information. I know a lot of things. I know mathematics, I know science, I know language. All of these I've gathered from books. I've read it from texts, right? And among the books I've read, probably a few of the books are Upanishads and some of the books are Vedantic books. And in that manner, I know that I am not this body, I am the Atma that is divine. But we are not referring to such knowledge or such knowing. We are talking about deep-rooted knowledge that changes everything about that person's perspective and that person's life. Jnana avasthita chetasaha. Jnana that is deeply rooted in the mind. So much so that it leads to gata sangha and mukti. Makes attachment leave completely and liberates one person. Also, he goes on to say, yajnaya acharataha, which means he undertakes karma for the purpose of a yajna or performs all actions as a yajna. For such a person, he says, karma samagram praviliyate. Praviliyate means gets dissolved or destroyed. Karma samagram means karma in its entirety. What is the meaning of this samagram when we say karma in its entirety is completely dissolved? When karma is performed by a jnani, there is no karma itself, right? Even though he is acting, he is not acting, and that's the concept we spoke about as akarma and karma. So he is acting, but he is not acting, and there is no consequence of that karma too. That concept of karma is also not there. So as we've been seeing the pattern in the past few shlokas, all of these are to be looked at as hints for karma yogi, right? So when Krishna says that this particular statement, karma samagram praviliyate, karma in its entirety is lost, we will have to look at what is karma, what is Krishna referring to, and why is he speaking about the idea of yajna also. But before we move to all of that, and before we move to the next shloka, I'd like to talk a little about what Krishna is trying to establish here, and what is the scope of this text of the Bhagavad Gita itself. And I'm making this point specifically at this junction because this is a portion which very beautifully captures the idea of the Bhagavad Gita itself. At the end of each chapter of the Gita, traditionally a shloka is often added to say that this is the end of this particular chapter. This is the first chapter, second chapter, whatever. And it says that the name is so and so. And it's something like an epilogue, right? I think I might have played it for one of the chapters. I'll probably play out that shloka once again, because it not only says that this is the end of the chapter, it says something very important about the Gita itself. So we'll just listen to that and then I'll take it from there.
Iti Srimad Bhagavad Gita Su Upanishatsu Brahma Vidyayam Yoga Shastre Shri Krishna Arjuna Samvade Arjuna Vishada Yogo Nama Prathamodhyayaha.
So this is the one that comes in the end of the first chapter. As you would have heard it, it says Vishada Yoga Nama Prathama Adhyayaha, which means this is the Vishada Yoga, which is the first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, which we just concluded. But apart from serving as a epilogue for a chapter, it also tells us what the Gita is all about. In Sanatana Dharma, we have many types of works. Some of them are referred to as itihasas. They are historical works. Some of the epics come under itihasas. Ramayana is itihasa. Mahabharata, in which the Bhagavad Gita is found, is also a itihasa. And then you have works that teach how to lead life. For example, Manusmriti or Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. And there are some Dharma Shastras. How to lead life, and how to lead life in such a manner that you progress towards the purpose of life. And these are referred to as Yoga Sutras or Dharma Shastras or, you know, Yoga Shastras. There are different words for that. But these are one set of literature in Sanatana Dharma. And then you have some books that are referred to as Brahma Shastras. They speak of the ultimate truth. For example, the Brahma Sutras, that is one text which does not necessarily teach you how to get there, but it only gives you a description of that state. It only gives you a description of the truth. What is the nature of the Atma? What is the nature of Brahman? What is the nature of Maya? And all of that. It speaks about the truth. And these are referred to as the Brahma Shastras. But the beauty of the Bhagavad Gita is that it is all of this. It is part of an itihasa, and it is a form of a conversation between two historical characters, Lord Krishna and Arjuna. And that's why that epilogue says, Shri Krishna Arjuna Samvade. It's a conversation between Lord Krishna and Arjuna. Then it goes on to describe the contents of the Gita. It says, Iti Srimad Bhagavad Gita Su Upanishadsu. Reiterating that it is an Upanishad, which means it is a Shruti. And we've discussed how Gita is a Shruti because it is directly coming from Bhagavan himself. Then it says, Brahma Vidyana, meaning it is a Brahma Shastra. It is teaching the nature of the Brahman. We've seen that in the second chapter where Krishna spoke extensively about the self and the nature of the self. But the shloka also adds Yoga Shastra, meaning it is not only a Brahma Shastra, it is also a Yoga Shastra, which means it speaks of the practical means by which you can get to the truth. So the Gita is a beautiful blend of the abstract, the practical. The whole discourse has a historical background too, making it so much more relatable. And this portion of the chapter kind of brings together all these aspects, and it kind of typifies what the Bhagavad Gita stands for. Now, if you were to look at the Vedas themselves, which happen to be the basis of Sanatana Dharma, it can be said to have three distinct portions. They are called the Karma Kanda, the Upasana Kanda, and the Jnana Kanda. The Karma Kanda is the portion that speaks of actions and duties and dharmas and all of that. And in the Vedas, a lot of emphasis is given especially on ritualistic actions, right? What one has to do every day, what is referred to as nitya karmas. These are ritualistic practices or prayers that you're supposed to do every day. And then there is something called naimittika karma, which means on special occasions, when there is a marriage, when there is a thread ceremony, when there is a naming ceremony, or somebody's death anniversary, what are the karmas that need to be performed? It's called naimittika karma, which literally means occasional actions. And then you have something called kamya karmas. I want to achieve something. I want rains. I want children. Or I want better health. You have something that you want to achieve. And for that, is there any rituals I need to perform? Is there any worship I need to perform? Those are referred to as kamya karmas. And then you have prayaschitta karmas, as the name itself suggests, means by which you atone for mistakes that you've done knowingly or unknowingly. And then there is nishiddha karmas, which are karmas that are not to be done, prohibited actions. So as you can see, a large part of the Vedas is dedicated to all these descriptions of the various karmas that need to be performed, how it has to be performed, and who has to perform it. If you're a kshatriya, what you're supposed to do. If you're a brahmana, what you're supposed to do. If you're a child, what you're supposed to do. If you're an elderly person, what you're supposed to do, right? So much of emphasis, a good part of the Vedas are on these kind of various kind of karmas that need to be performed. And this part is referred to as the Karma Kanda of the Vedas. Simple translation the portion of the Veda that speaks about actions, Karma Kanda. Then there is what is referred to as the Upasana Kanda. The word Upasana, as we know, means worship. So this section speaks about the various deities and how to propitiate them, your Indra, your Rudra, your Agni, and your Varuna and Vayu, and all of these different deities, Marutis and Adityas. So it speaks about what prayers need to be done to please them, how you can meditate upon them, and how you can win their grace, all of these things. So it speaks about the worship that one has to perform to some of these unseen forces, right? They're not in front of you, but you ways of propitiating them. The last section of the Vedas is what is referred to as Jnana Kanda, where what we refer to as Vedanta or the Upanishads are all mentioned. And these speak about pure Brahma Vidya. They speak about the supreme truth. Now, there are different schools of Vedanta that propagate that only a certain section of the Vedas are important and they are sufficient to lead life that is purposeful. The school that suggests that Karma Kanda is the most important is referred to as Karma Mimamsa. The word Mimamsa itself means study or deep learning. So Karma Mimamsa means the school that studies only the karma, is concentrates on the various rituals and actions that the Veda speaks about. This school is also referred to as Purva Mimamsa. The word Purva means the initial part or the earlier part. And since the initial or earlier part of the Vedas emphasizes and stresses on karma, the school is also called the Purva Mimamsa school. Now, these people believe that all that one has to do is do these rituals to perfection, perform one's dharma and duties to as perfect a way as possible, and that is all that is required. There is no need for prayers or any kind of supreme knowledge. If you're able to lead your life in this manner, then you're good, right? And what is the best thing that you can get through the good actions that you perform? They say a good birth, and the highest reward they think of good karma is reaching heaven. Now, the Karma Mimamsakas believe that in life, whatever we do everything in search of happiness and peace, which is understandable, which is quite true in that sense. So when we have a good birth and say we have a healthy body and we are born into an affluent family, so this happiness and peace comes more naturally to us, more easily to us, right? So that is why they say when you perform good karmas, when you do all of these yagas and yajnas as prescribed for your age and for your birth and all of that, you will eventually be born in a better family, you will be born with a better body, which is more healthy, and happiness and peace becomes more easily accessible. And the ultimate state of having that such kind of happiness and peace is what is referred to as the concept of Swarga or heaven. So they always believe that, you know, good karmas will lead to a better birth. And if you've done very, very good karmas, you deserve a place in heaven. So the Karma Mimamsaka suggests that we must do our actions with sincerity, with morality, and complete all our duties, and that is all is important in life. Now, if you look at the Uttara Mimamsa school, Uttara means the later part, and the Uttara Mimamsa is also called the Jnana Mimamsa, those who believe that the Vedas always emphasize only the Jnana aspect or the knowledge aspect. Now, they say that the Jnana is the ultimate, and that alone is the message of the Vedas. And when Jnana is the ultimate, a life that is purely dedicated to the pursuit of Jnana is the best one, and that's quite understandable. So invariably, the Jnana Mimamsa school, not necessarily always, but invariably, they tend towards a life of sannyasa, where you give up all actions, where you give up all other worldly achievements and aspirations, and you concentrate only on the pursuit of Jnana. Take to a life of sannyasa or renunciation. The people who believe in Upasana or the path of worship, they can be spoken of being a bit widespread, partly in this camp and partly in that camp. Some of them might probably be householders who seek benefits from gods for a happier life, or they could even be reclusive worshippers. They could be bhaktas who have given up hearth and home and they become renunciants, but they're not in search of jnana. They are in the bliss of worshipping the Lord, right? So they believe that this is the ultimate state that can be earned through our life on planet. So these are the different approaches, and as you would have guessed it, these three more or less represent the three pathways to God, and that is what Swami says: Karma Marga, Bhakti Marga, and Jnana Marga. And this is not actually so different from our understanding in the modern world too. We actually come across many kind of these people. When you talk about the Purva Mimamsa people who say that, you know, actions have to be performed perfectly, we need not necessarily look at them only as very ritualistic people. I think even in the modern day, we find people who say that, you know, I don't believe in heaven and I don't believe in gods. I don't believe in, agnostic people, but they're not bad people. They say that, no, I have to follow a moral life. I need to do what I'm supposed to do. I have to perform all my duties. If there's somebody in need, they'll go out and help, right? So they talk about leading a perfect life in earth and in whatever is seen around. And, you know, there is nothing that is beyond what is seen. These probably can be referred to as people who are, you know, more or less tending towards the Purva Mimamsa school. And similarly, you have people who are, you know, who probably depend more on upasana than on karma. You have people who are all the time dedicating themselves to puja and puraskaras. The desires are not gone away, and they're also not necessarily bad people, but the dependence on worship is a little more, and dependence on God in that sense to achieve whatever they want to achieve is a little more compared to others. And these could be referred to as people who fall under this category of the Upasana Kanda people of the Vedas. And similarly, you have the the Jnana Kanda people. Again, these need not necessarily be people who are talking about highest philosophy or Vedanta, but you have some of these people who always talk about a free spirit, who talk about, you know, there are no rules and there's no good and bad, there's no right and wrong. I think sometimes we all go into that phase briefly and come out of it too. So this could be spoken of as somebody who is saying that that is the most important aspect of life. So when we talk about Purva Mimamsa, Uttara Mimamsa, it is not necessarily a description of the Vedic era. We find it even in the modern day, and I think that's the point I was trying to make. But let's get back to the Gita and see what the Gita is trying to do and why did I mention all of this about the Vedas. So what does the Gita do in this background? As I mentioned, it is an Upanishad, it is a Yoga Shastra and a Brahma Shastra. And added to that, there is also the component of bhakti, because the whole thing is a discourse from Lord Krishna to Arjuna, because Arjuna has submitted himself worshipfully to Krishna. And that is why in the Curtain Raiser episode of this entire series, I mentioned that in the true sense, the Gita is actually a triune pilgrimage which brings together all of these aspects, these three aspects of the Vedas, or these three aspects of bhakti, karma and jnana. And Gita bridges all of these, not only bringing them all together, but also giving the most important message that you cannot look at one without giving the relevant place and importance for the other two aspects. The string that Krishna uses to bind all of these approaches, as we have seen so far, is the concept of Karma Yoga. And the Karma Yoga is what he is using to beautifully bridge between the jnani who is already out of there, I mean, he's beyond our scope, and he's bridging the fellow who's doing karma on an everyday basis, and he is also speaking of performing actions with a worshipful attitude. So he is bringing in upasana also. And the reason for that is, all these three, as I said, are equally important. In fact, let me read out a small portion from a discourse where Swami makes this very, very clear that you cannot separate karma, upasana and jnana. And this is a quote from a discourse that Swami delivered on 4th October 1989. And Swami says, and I quote, "To reach the stage of a jnani, the first steps are karma and upasana. Without following these and succeeding in them, one can never become a jnani. Just as a student cannot acquire degree without passing the school final and intermediate examinations. It is idle for anyone to claim that he is a jnani unless he has gone through the prior disciplines. It is for this reason that the Veda has placed Karma Kanda, the Upasana Kanda and the Jnana Kanda in that order of succession. To realize the oneness of divinity, these three paths of action, worship and knowledge have been laid down. The world today abounds in Vedantins who go about claiming that they are jnanis. Among myriad such claimants, not one can be regarded as a real jnani. To become a jnani, the first step is to start with the karma marga, the path of action. The sacred duties laid down in the discipline have to be practiced. All actions have to be performed as a dedicatory offering to God. Without doing the prescribed rites, merely declaring the actions one performs as an offering to God is futile. Set aside your likes and dislikes. Perform right actions with discrimination after due inquiry. If you are unable to ascertain what actions the Vedas prescribe, act according to the dictates of your conscience. Thereby, your actions get sanctified. It is not necessary to study the scriptural texts. Any action done with a pure heart becomes holy." End of quote. So Swami makes it very, very clear that we cannot differentiate karma, upasana and jnana until one becomes a jnani. Once somebody reaches that state of a jnani, we will find that all of these lines completely blur away, and we will see that in the next shloka too. But till then, karma is important. Worship is important too. And Gita, the yoga shastra that Gita is, that is the text which gives us the way to reach the goal. The yoga shastra Gita gives the karma yoga as the means. And in a way, this concept of yajna, which we are talking about, which Krishna mentioned in the previous chapter and is going previous verse, and is going to again mention in the next verse, is like a concept that kind of connects all these three. And that is why I spoke about karma, upasana and jnana here, because yajna is specifically being used as a tool. The other reason for that is, you know, from the historical context, if you look at the practice of yajna or the ritualistic fire sacrifice, that was something which was pretty much common to people who were in all of these categories, right? Even the Purva Mimamsakas performed yajna. The Upasana people, of course, performed yajna. And even the people who spoke about the Karma Kanda, I'm sorry, the Jnana Kanda, the Uttara Mimamsakas, even they spoke about the importance of yajna. So that is a act which is pretty much accepted by all these categories, and that is one more reason why yajna is being given special importance and being spoken of here, because the whole idea of the Gita is to bring together all of these pathways. Before we go to the next verse, I will connect this back to what I just mentioned before I went into this small digression into what the Vedas are, how the Vedas are differentiated. When we say that in the case of a jnani, the karmas are completely removed, the word samagram, karma samagram, which means in its entirety it is lost, it is a specific important point where he is making a reference to the idea of a karma mimamsaka person performing actions. He also does yajnas, but as I said, the highest good that he can gain according to him through a yajna is a place in the heaven, right? And when we look at it from the point of view of karma yoga, or from the point of view of the jnani whom Krishna is speaking about, even a place in heaven is seen as a bondage, right? So when he's talking of a karma yoga, when he's talking about a jnani, and he's saying that he also performs yajnas, he also performs his actions as yajnas, but in his case, all actions are completely sublimated, which means he's doing the same action which probably a Purva Mimamsaka person does, but the way he does it is in such a way that the reward of heaven is also not there in the case of a jnani, right? So again, the idea is to describe the jnani in terms of, say, a karma yogi or a person who believes in performing only karmas. So that is the general refrain which is being tried, which is being used in all of these verses. In the next verse, Krishna explains the yajna of a jnani in more detail. How does a jnani look at the process of yajna? So when we talk of karma yoga being the string which brings together all of these, it has to have the idea of scrupulousness of karma mimamsa approach. It should bring together the idea of faith and devotional aspect of the upasana approach, and the mental attitude which is going to be mentioned in the next verse, which is related to the idea of a jnani. And the next verse also happens to be a very, very popular verse. Most of us are likely to be very familiar with the verse, and I'm sure some of us chant it multiple times a day. So today it's going to give us an opportunity to really look at the meaning of this verse, which probably we are chanting because of habit, and see what is it, what is the real meaning of this verse, and what is the idea behind Swami making us chant this verse every day. We will listen to the verse, you'll understand what I'm talking about, and then we'll discuss about it in a little more detail.
Brahmarpanam brahmahavihi brahmagnau brahmanahutam brahmaivatena gantavyam brahmakarma samadhina.
The means of offering is Brahman, the oblation is Brahman, offered by Brahman into the fire which is Brahman. Brahman indeed is to be reached by him who sees everything as Brahman. So there it is, verse number 24, more popularly known as our food prayer. Most of us chant it in our schools and colleges. We learnt it and we chant it before we eat our food, which has become a habit for all of us. But interestingly, it appears in the description of a jnani, not in the description of a bhakta or a devotee. Because when we chant it as a food prayer, we are offering it to Swami. But here, the food prayer actually comes in a place where Krishna is describing a jnani, and also in the context of a yajna. So why do we use it as a food prayer? Which means we are supposed to consider the act of eating itself as a yajna. What is the purpose of a yajna, truly speaking? To receive something, right? But to receive it as prasadam. That is why we had discussed when we spoke about yajnas in the third chapter, instead of me doing some action and saying, I want these results, so I'm doing these actions. Instead of that, the concept of yajna is, whatever we do it as an offering. And whatever comes, which is actually the consequence of our actions, we receive it as being prasadam from God. Similarly, that is how we are supposed to consume our food too. Why do we eat food? For nourishment, right? For energy, so that with that energy we can carry out our actions. So the act of eating becomes an offering, and the energy received from the food becomes prasadam. And the jataragni in the stomach, the digestive fires, is the sacrificial fire if you were to consider the act of eating as a yajna. Since we are supposed to eat with that sense of offering, like we are performing a yajna, this has traditionally been used as the food prayer. And if you look at it, isn't it a very, very beautiful thought that every day we are making offerings to God through the fire in our own stomachs? Every day we are all performing yajnas, whether we realize it or not. And if you're able to chant the Brahmarpanam prayer and being conscious of it, we all are performing yajna 3 times a day. What a beautiful thought that is. And of course, Swami adds another verse from the Bhagavad Gita, which actually comes in the later chapters. It comes in the 15th chapter where Swami says, Aham vaishvanaro bhutva praninam deham ashritaha pranapana samayuktaha pachamyannam chaturvidham. Where Krishna says, yes, you offer it to me, but I exist as Vaishvanara, the digestive fire in the body of every being, and I am the one who digests the different types of food that you consume. Of course, we'll go through the verse in detail when we come to it, but isn't it a beautiful tradition to think of the act of eating itself as an offering, as in yajna, and the energy and vitality that we receive from the food to look at it as a gift of grace from God. If we remind ourselves of this every day when we eat our food, I think it would be impossible for us to misuse our limbs, our faculty of speech, our faculty of listening and speaking and, and all the other senses, right? Because all of these comes from the food that we eat. It draws energy from the food that we eat. I still recall, when we were students in Vrindavan, Swami once distributed for all of us what we refer to as Walkmans, right? Usually Swami would give us clothes, Swami would give us some other items, but this was a very special gift that Swami gave all of us in our class. Swami gave us Walkmans, and I'm sure the younger listeners might not even know what a Walkman is. It's a portable audio cassette player, which used to be very popular before your MP3 players and iPods and all came into becoming so popular. So Swami gave us all these Walkmans, and at that age, we also loved listening to all kinds of popular music. But we would be very, very hesitant to play any film or pop music on this particular Walkman. Why? Because Swami has given it to us himself. Well, I'm not saying that this music is good or that is bad. I think that judgment is completely left to each individual. But the point I'm trying to make is, the moment we think that something has been given by Swami, we automatically bring in the concept of discrimination, we bring in buddhi, and we wonder and ask ourselves this question, is this all right? Can I do this? Can I not do this? And a simple thing of a Walkman, it's not that we did not listen to film music, but we would hesitate to put a film music cassette in that Walkman. Why? Because it has been given to us by Swami. So imagine if we are able to think like that about the nourishment and energy that we draw from food. If we are able to look at it as we performing a yajna and that is a gift of God, the idea of discrimination, the idea of applying our buddhi, which is fundamental to the spiritual path, will become a very natural thing, right? But let us come back to this particular shloka. It has a more profound meaning than just saying that I offer this food to God, because this Krishna says is how a jnani looks at the act of yajna. He's not talking about how you and I look at it. He says this is how a jnani looks at the idea of a yajna. And from that we can see what happens even to our food prayer and even to our idea of performing all actions as a yajna. Krishna says Brahmarpanam, which is a compound word, like all others in the shloka, Brahma Arpanam. Brahma, of course, is Brahman, the Supreme. The word Arpanam means offering or the act of offering. But when we are speaking about the ritualistic practice of a yajna, a fire sacrifice, a traditional Vedic fire sacrifice, the ladle which is used is referred to as Arpana in a ritualistic sacrifice. So in general, we can refer to any implement we use to make this offering, So if we talk about offering all our actions to God, then what is the tool that we use through which we make the offering? It is this body, right? With all its limbs and senses and vitality, we perform actions. So when Krishna says Brahm Arpanam, the ladle or the implement used for the offering is itself Brahman. And then he goes on to say, Brahma Havihi. Havihi is the ghee or the clarified butter that is offered in the fire. Krishna says the jnani sees the offering, the Havihi, as also Brahman. Brahmagnau. He sees the fire into which this offering is made as also Brahman. Brahmanahutam. And it is being offered by Brahman. Meaning the person performing the yajna is also Brahman. Brahmaiva tena gantavyam. And Brahman alone is reached by such a person. By what kind of a person? Brahma karma samadhina. One who is considering everything, all actions and all of these paraphernalia, everything as Brahman. Such a person, Brahmaiva tena gantavyam, reaches also Brahman. So what is Krishna doing here? He is still describing a jnani. And who is a jnani? The one who has jnana. And what is jnana? As Swami would often say, Advaita darshanam jnanam. Multiplicity is a mirage, and the underlying truth, which is one, which is indivisible and divine, alone is the truth. So a jnani is one who sees the truth, who sees the Brahman, who sees the tattva, things as they are. I think all of these has been very clearly established. We have mentioned all of this before. But still Krishna says a jnani is one who sees the offering as Brahman, the fire as Brahman, the ghee as Brahman, the ladle as Brahman, the state that is reached also as Brahman. One of the Upanishads say, if you know the clay, you know all the pots. So a jnani is one who recognizes that everything has come from Brahman and remains only Brahman. So he sees the one performing the yajna, the ghee offered in the yajna, all of these as Brahman, because in reality, in truth, they are only physical, limited manifestations of that same Brahma. The same clay which has taken different forms. The moment you recognize the clay, you recognize the clay in all of these different forms. The process of yajna is very important for a karma yogi. But the same yajna is nothing but a role play for a jnani. Right? When we talk about a karma yogi, Krishna said, Arjuna, perform all your actions like a yajna. So for a karma yogi, the concept is very important. But when you look at it from the point of view of a jnani, he looks at all of this as a mono act play being done by Brahman. Suppose I take you to my house and I show you around and I say, this is my house. And then I tell you, this is my house. This door is also mine. That floor is also mine. That sink over there, that is also mine. That window, that is also mine. That door, that is also mine. You will think that there's something wrong with me, isn't it? When I say the house is mine, it is kind of understood that everything else is also mine. It seems like a simple logic, and somebody who probably speaks like this will be looked at as someone who has lost their mental balance. But the fact is, to say that this house is mine and to understand that everything else is understood, right? The door, the window, and everything also is contained in that house, and by extension of that, everything else belongs to me. If you look at it, both of us should be operating in the same level of understanding. Or our understanding of when I say my house, what it means, should be the same in your mind as well as in my mind. Right? Only when there is a matching of the understanding, it is understood that when you say this is my house, everything else is contained. But here, that is not the case. In fact, this is Vedanta's approach, if I could say it that way. And that's why I said in the beginning, the repetitiveness of Vedanta comes for a certain specific purpose. It keeps repeating the obvious because it is not yet our knowledge. It is only information and data at this point in time. We had seen this even in the second chapter, the description of the self. The moment you call it eternal, it is enough. But it is described as, it is unborn, it is undying, it is unchanging. Why was that done like that? Why did Krishna use all of these phrases to describe the self after saying that it is eternal? When you tell me that the soul is eternal, that knowledge is supposed to make me worry-free, isn't it? But I'm likely to forget this truth under certain conditions. For example, when my body undergoes change in the name of aging, or when I encounter death and so on. So the same truth is said in so many ways so that I can think of it in different contexts. Why was Krishna saying all of this to Arjuna? Because Arjuna was thinking that he is going to kill somebody. And Krishna said, no, no, don't worry, because it is undying. If somebody is worrying about becoming old, if somebody is worrying about some modifications happening in the body, then the fact that the soul is unchanging, that description becomes useful to me. Right? When I think of getting attached to a newborn child, the fact that the soul is never born, that description becomes useful to me to deal with that attachment, right? So in the same way, for the jnani, there is no concept of an offering. When there is only one, where is the question of one who is offering and one who is receiving the offering? But for a karma yogi, a yajna is a means to that knowledge, but still he has this idea of these separate utilities which are involved in that yajna. So first, for a person doing regular karma, the idea that doing action as yajna is an improvement from that state. Just like how praying before you eat is an improvement over simply gobbling your food. But what is the speciality of mentioning the nature of the jnani by mentioning that for him the ghee is Brahman, the fire is Brahman, the offerer is Brahman and so on. When I offer my food to Swami, let us say, it is easy to think that I am offering it to God. I can probably also think that my digestive power is also a gift of God. I think that is another idea that might be easy to attain for me. We say Annam Brahma, which means the food is God. I think that also is a concept which probably is approachable. So we think of each of these ideas separately. And there are benefits to be gained by each of these attitudes, right? Each of these makes us lead a more dharmic life by saying that, you know, the digestive food is God, the food is God, the digestive force inside me is God. So each one of these helps us lead a certain dharmic life. But the ultimate comes from the sense of oneness. So the idea is, think of the ultimate even when you are doing something in the mundane level. For the jnani, there is no duality. So for him, when you say Brahma Arpanam, Brahma Vir, Brahma Agna, Brahma Hotam, it's actually a superfluous description for a jnani. But when you look at it from the point of view of a karma yogi, the karma yogi is being told, you do actions as a yajna. And then to him it is told that even as you perform your actions as a yajna, remember, the one who is doing is Brahman, the one which is being done is Brahman, the one to whom it is being offered is Brahman, and the state that you will reach eventually doing all of this is also Brahman. Right? And this actually is the idea of what we refer to as upasana or worship. We do a physical act thinking of, say, a mental offering. You know, when we are doing archana, we take flowers or we take akshatas and then we offer it to God, we chant a name. The whole idea is, it's a physical act, but there is a mental concept of surrendering or dedicating or, offering our thoughts to God or offering our actions to God, right? So we are performing a mundane action with a more superior and complex mental concept in our mind, right? And that is what is referred to as upasana itself. We are constantly superimposing an abstract idea over a mundane activity. For that matter, even the idea of worshipping, an idol, right? The idol is probably a rock or a metal or whatever it is. But we are superimposing the idea of divinity over that idol. And that is what is referred to as worship. We start praying to that idol. But the idea is to eventually experience God beyond that superimposition over that idol, isn't it? We are not going to be stuck with the idea that that idol alone is God. It is a representation. It is a process by which we are trying to truly experience God. Similarly, when we chant Brahmarpanam before eating, or if we were to do yajna by saying, I am Brahman, the fire is Brahman, the ladle is Brahman, and so on, in front of me, the objects are different. There is ghee, there is a ladle, there is a fire, I am sitting here, and I want something. All of these things are in front of me as separate objects. I am superimposing this idea over this physical act that all of this is Brahman. Just like how I superimpose the idea of divinity over a rock or a metal idol, similarly, the act of yajna involves all of these things and they are all separate entities in front of me. But I am superimposing this idea of Brahmarpanam, Brahma Havir, Brahma Agno, Brahma Nahutam on this physical mundane activity. Right? And this is what is referred to as upasana. And when we reach a state of anyani, the superimposition actually becomes meaningless and no more necessary because there is no duality at all. So there is no idea of I don't have to force myself to see God in a rock. I see God alone. The rock literally melts in my idea. Similarly, when you reach the state of anyani, you don't have to do the superimposition, but we use this process of superimposition, which is referred to as upasana, to bring together a very mundane physical activity and take it to the level of jnana. And this is what the Bhagavad Gita tries to do. You have the path of karma, what actions have to be performed, what duties have to be performed, what are the rituals that need to be performed. And then you have the idea of jnana, which is beyond all of this. There is nothing that can be done or performed or acted to get that jnana. But using this process of upasana, Krishna is bridging karma and jnana and bringing all of this to one. And that is what we refer to as the triune pilgrimage, and we keep talking about it, right? So the whole idea of the Gita is that it is a Brahma Shastra because it speaks of the ultimate truth, but it is also a Yoga Shastra because it gives us the means by getting there, and the means is upasana. And in these few verses, Krishna uses a concept which is common to all of these three, which is a ritual called yajna, and brings all of this together. And we will see in the next few verses, Krishna speaks further about yajna, and he says different kind of yajnas. And all of these he speaks of in the context of how does a jnani look at all of these yajnas. So that we perform these yajnas in a day-to-day life. It's not necessarily that you sit in front of a fire and perform these yagas and yajnas. But the way we go about in our life, we look at, just like how I said, the act of eating is supposed to be considered a yajna. And even as we are doing that, we are making an offering of that to God, and we are saying that the energy that comes from it is prasadam. But we are superimposing even that idea with the supreme idea that I am also God, the food is also God, and I am offering it also to God. Right? That is almost like the second level of superimposition over the idea of simply, you know, the simple idea is eating food. We are superimposing that with the idea that it is an offering to God and the energy is a prasadam. And even that is being superimposed with this idea that there is no two at all. Everything is one and the same. Right? So that is the whole idea of bringing together karma, upasana and jnana. And I think it's better I wind up now. I've taken a little extra time already. Thank you, dear listeners, for being with me. We'll continue with this chapter and continue with whatever Krishna says about the idea of yajna. Do join me again next week at 7:30 p.m. for the resumption of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. And we saw today what is the relevance of calling it the Triune Pilgrimage. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the last segment of today's Thursday Live. I'll join you all again next week. Till then, take care. Happy listening. Jai Sai Ram.